History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk.
Quick update this morning on some breaking news we brought you in the last hour, and that is the Pentagon confirming there has been an explosion outside Kabul airport, where thousands of people have gathered to try to evacuate the country. Initial reports suggest it was caused by a suicide bomber and that there are casualties. The president has been briefed.
That was the scene 3 years ago as Kabul descended into anarchy with the rapid collapse of the Afghan government. It was a horrific scene, punctuated by the explosion of a suicide bomber at an airport gate that killed over 183 people, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. service members. Then came stomach-churning images of panicked Afghans running alongside giant U.S. Air Force transport planes taxiing along the runways. Some of those people clinging to wheel wells, desperate to get out of the country as truckloads of Taliban gunmen rumbled into the capital and took over government buildings. And then there was silence. The last aircraft gone. The 20-year-long American enterprise finally, dramatically, at an end. Not many Americans want to hear about Afghanistan on this dolorous anniversary, especially the U.S. officials who were responsible for two decades worth of upbeat, misleading progress reports. Let's call them for what they were, lies about the war's progress, right up to the bitter end on August 30th, 2021. The official subterfuge was thoroughly documented by top Washington Post investigative reporter Craig Whitlock in his revealing 2021 book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War, which, in a startling bit of coincidental timing, just happened to be published on the day after the runways went silent at Hamid Karzai International Airport. Whitlock is my guest today to talk about lessons learned and not from Afghanistan, as well as secret ties that exist today between the CIA and the Taliban. Craig Whitlock, welcome back to Spy Talk. It's so great to have you back again on the show. I'm wondering, you wrote to me the best book on Afghanistan, and I'm wondering what you're thinking today on the third anniversary of the chaotic withdrawal from Kabul. Is it on your mind, or are you, like, I dare say, most Americans have it in the rearview mirror, it's gone, it's ancient history? What are you thinking?
I think most Americans, yeah, would like to forget about it, but on the third anniversary, it's still a very jarring reality. Recently, a couple weeks ago, the Taliban had a parade, a military parade at Bagram Air Base, where they were showing off a lot of military equipment that they'd seized from the Afghan National Army and police forces, which, of course, was military equipment that had been donated by the United States and NATO. And, you know, they had a lot of Taliban army people in uniform, and they weren't looking like this guerrilla force anymore. They looked like this well-equipped foreign military.
NATO. They looked like a NATO army.
Right. And, you know, that those images on their own were pretty jarring. But I think they send a message in two regards. One is there's no question the Taliban's in full control of Afghanistan 3 years later. They've cemented their control over the country. But also, you know, they're forever going to be bragging about how they defeated the United States military. And, you know, of course, their myth before that is that they defeated the Red Army, the Soviet Army, even though that wasn't the Taliban itself. Those were the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So, you know, their narrative, their mythology is pretty powerful in that regard, that they can claim that, you know, that God essentially was on their side and they defeated the world's two superpowers. And, you know, but the reality is they're in control of the country, and they did that. And yeah. I think that's still for most Americans, it's hard to get their heads around.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get my head around sometimes when I look at it. When I saw that same video the other day, it's really quite striking. And of course, it hardly needs reminding that we helped the Taliban defeat the Soviet Red Army in Afghanistan, one of the many ironies. And then, you know, then we invade and they end up ushering us out and driving around our military equipment. You know, Afghanistan is one big ironic puzzle. They do have a challenge, however, internally from ISIS-K, which we have heard has designs on major attacks in Western Europe and the United States. How much of a threat does ISIS-K pose to them, do you think?
That's to the Taliban, I don't think much of a threat. I think there are some, you know, we certainly haven't seen the number of attacks in Kabul or other populated city centers that had been the case in 2019, 2020, 2021 that ISIS-K was responsible for. We haven't seen, you know, certainly they've been more subdued than they used to be in terms of what activities they're taking in Afghanistan. And, you know, in the past, they were pretty much confined to the eastern part of the country. They would send suicide bombers to Kabul or Kandahar or something. But, you know, they haven't really emerged any stronger since 2021 in terms of a threat to the Taliban. I think the Taliban has really cemented their control over the country. And yes, there's still ISIS-K in eastern Afghanistan, but I don't get the sense that their numbers have grown or their threat has grown to the Taliban. I think it's an open question for debate how much of a threat they pose outside Afghanistan. Certainly they have aspirations to do things. We've seen them recruiting some Central Asian followers. But, you know, even then, you know, there was a lot of gloom and doom talk when the United States military withdrew in 2021 about what sort of threats might emanate from Afghanistan back to the homeland. And we really haven't seen any really strong, credible threats or plots or attacks, certainly in the past 3 years. It doesn't mean something couldn't happen, something mm-hmm. could be in the works, but you know that you know there were a lot of predictions that you know there would be transnational terrorism would take root in Afghanistan, but it so far at least not good. It hasn't come to pass.
Do you think that ISIS? I don't want to dwell on this forever, but do you think that ISIS, that the Taliban tolerate ISIS-K because of, you know, its threats to the West?
I don't think so. Just their religious ideologies are very different. That they were mortal enemies. If anything, I think the CIA and the Taliban have, you know, they don't talk about this publicly very much, but clearly there is indication that the CIA and the Taliban at least share some information and both see a common cause in trying to extinguish any threat from ISIS-K. You'll remember that Bill Burns, the CIA director, visited Kabul right as everything was going to hell in August 2015 and met with Taliban leaders. And there was, I think, some discussion, obviously, about the withdrawal, but you know, clearly there's lines of communication there between the Taliban and the CIA, directly or indirectly. And I'm sure that, you know, the top thing on their agenda, if they do have communications, is ISIS-K.
Well, you anticipated my question, actually. I was going to ask you about the CIA relationship with the Taliban and mutual interests and so on. I think David Cohen, the deputy director, also made a trip to Afghanistan. So how do you think this works, by the way, the CIA-Taliban relationship? Is it through a third party, or do you think there's a kind of a secret communication channel that they have?
Well, this is speculation on my part. I don't have firsthand knowledge, but there are any number of avenues they could take for communications. I mean, the most obvious one would be through Qatar, where the Taliban have long had an office, and that's where the United States was involved negotiating with them before 2021. And the Qataris, if anything, have held themselves out more in other conflicts around the world as a mediator, such as in the war in Gaza. You know, there's been talk about them serving as mediators between the Ukrainians and the Russians. Hmm. So, you know, the Taliban, that's one of the few places that they have some sort of enduring diplomatic presence in Qatar. You know, no country in the world has given official recognition to the Taliban government so far. But, you know, the Taliban has been able to open some de facto embassy still with a diplomatic presence in a number of countries in Central Asia. And they do have a longstanding office in Qatar. So that would be an obvious place, I think, for, you know, the Americans and the CIA to have ongoing contacts with the Taliban.
And do they have a housekeeping relationship to take care of their the former Afghanistan embassy here, do you think? Someone taking care of it?
Well, they do. And so I don't know the latest on the embassy in Washington, but in a number of countries, actually, you have Afghan diplomats who were part of the old government still remaining in control of the embassies in Western countries.
Huh.
And this has been a situation in countries around the world. And slowly, the Taliban has been trying to regain control of these different embassies. It's kind of a quiet approach. But for instance, now the Taliban has a regular representation in Moscow, even though, again, the Russians haven't extended full diplomatic recognition of the Taliban. You know, de facto behind the scenes that, you know, they have an embassy up and running in Moscow, and there's places that you can go and if you're an Afghan citizen to submit passports and things like this. So slowly, very slowly, the Taliban is trying to get more de facto international recognition. It's worked out the best for them in Central Asia with its neighbors like Iran and Pakistan, even though the Taliban has always had a fraught relationship with Iran and a very mixed relationship with the government of Pakistan. They, you know, they're slowly gaining, you know, de facto links with these countries diplomatically and security wise. So, you know, the Taliban is in this for the long haul. And I think they just know, they think, or they're banking on the idea that it's a matter of time before different countries, you know, recognize reality and give them diplomatic recognition.
I'm fascinated by what you said about Afghan embassies in, say, Western Europe, in which former regime officials are still there. Are they like squatters?
In some places, I mean, that's sort of a characterization I'll leave to you. But yes, you know, they would say that they are, you know, nobody recognizes the Taliban government. And so they were the last remaining accredited diplomats of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. So, you know, who's going to kick them out, right? The Taliban can't send somebody, you know, to Germany or I'm pulling countries out of a hat, but to Western countries to forcibly retake their embassies, right? You know, it's sort of depending on, you know, another country giving them recognition. But, you know, this happened to an extent with, people may remember with Venezuela, you know, there was a fight over who had controlled their embassy in the United States,
right,
in Washington. I don't think it's quite come to that extent, but certainly there is this transitional period. And I think also the Taliban has had essentially informal talks with former Afghan diplomats from the old regime trying to say, okay, look, will you look after the place for us? Or, you know, we won't come after you. Let's try and, you know, come to some sort of agreement here. But, you know, that's all taking place at various degrees of interaction in different countries. But one by one, the Taliban, again, they're playing the long game here, is they're trying to regain those connections, those diplomatic connections with different countries for both diplomatic reasons, trade reasons, but particularly humanitarian aid and things like that.
Maybe just because, you know, I run a thing called Spy Talk. that I'm imagining Western intelligence agencies putting a lattice work of electronic listening devices in all these fraud embassies.
Well, that may be. I don't know. You know, who knows what's going on there? But again, you know, I don't want to give the idea that Taliban's been flying their flag over all these embassies. But, you know, in Central Asia, most of those embassies in the region are now under the control of the Taliban, even if there's no diplomatic recognition. And I think they're just hoping that, you know, first the Russians and maybe the Chinese, you know, that would be some heavy hitters on the Security Council. You know, if they extended more recognition of the Taliban, then, you know, de facto, people are going to get the message they're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And it appears that the Taliban don't have the capability or the willpower or the desire to wipe out their former regime officials like the Iranians did after the Iranian Revolution. They went after officials and assassinated them in Europe and in the United States, close by here in Bethesda, I remember. An assassination of a former regime supporter. So we're not seeing anything like that by the Taliban.
We haven't seen anything like that, but, you know, it'd be really difficult for the Taliban to send people out of the country to do that sort of thing. But, you know, I think for them, they've got what they want. They've got control. They've got power in Afghanistan. You know, for the first time since the 1970s, there's no war raging within Afghanistan. And, you know, like it or not, most of the world, of course, obviously does not. The Taliban has more control now in Afghanistan than they did in August of 2001, before the United States invaded and 9/11 happened.
Hey, we have to step away for a minute. Okay, we're back. Well, speaking of the United States invasion and our long, muddy history there, you wrote, as I said at the beginning, the book to me on Afghanistan, the Afghanistan Papers. And in revisiting your book today, I began to wonder if there's intelligent life on Earth. You know, I mean, there, some of the quotes that come up in the reviews are that the President Bush didn't even know the name of his Afghanistan war commander and didn't want to make time to meet with him. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld admitted he had, quote, no visibility into who the bad guys are. His successor, Robert Gates, said, we don't know jack shit about Al-Qaeda. So how did, explain that to me.
Well, you know, one thing, as you know, Jeff, as a journalist, you hope things hold up over time, right? You know, a lot of times people are writing or broadcasting in the moment, breaking news or when we're still trying to unspool things. And, you know, when the Afghanistan Papers book came out, right as things were all going to hell in Afghanistan, it created a lot of controversy, right? A lot of people didn't really buy into the premise, the thesis of the book, which was for 20 years, the American people had been lied to about the progress of the war and that it was much worse than people knew, that for 20 years, people in charge of the war knew we weren't making progress, knew that this was turning into a fool's errand, but in public were telling the American people that they were making progress, that victory was around the corner, that things were going well. And people had, you know, people in the government had a hard time swallowing that, some people. I think it rang true to the public. They knew they had been gaslighted, and here was proof of it. But, you know, still while this was going on, 3 years ago, there were some people arguing that the United States could defeat the Taliban if we just sent more troops back, or that, you know, we could prop up the Afghan government and the Afghan army, and that, you know, the proper policy was to stay the course and keep a few thousand troops over there and have this turn into some kind of Central Asian version of the Korean War, right? This Cold War in that's divided up the Korean Peninsula. You know, but 3 years later, I feel pretty good about how this book held up, right? There's nothing in it nowadays that anyone is disputing. All the premises and all the incredible statements that people had said in these secret interviews, like you just ticked off some examples, you know, those all hold up. Those are all true. No one's disputing any of that. And with the passage of time, it looks more right than ever, you know, that, you know, that it's clear that this was a war that had fallen apart at the seams, that the strategy, the mission, the objectives, none of it really added up or made any sense, despite what people in charge of the Pentagon, the White House, and the State Department had been telling the public for 20 years. I think, you know, the history is pretty well settled on that.
You know, as a baby boomer and someone who served in Vietnam, I did a stint with Army Intelligence in Vietnam during the war. You know, this is like an exact echo, like a ghost from the past. These are exactly the same things that happened in Vietnam. Self-delusion, lying, lying to the American people, lying to themselves until the bitter end. And even, you know, in the last days of Vietnam, as the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong were closing in on Saigon, there were still business executives flying into Saigon with plans to build luxury hotels, you know. And we have to hear, you know, 40, 50 years later, we have the same thing happening in Afghanistan. And not to just keep, you know, noodling around in this open wound, but, you know, why isn't that more people didn't come forward and call bullshit on the whole Afghanistan thing, and, you know, more senior people?
Well, that's a really good question, and one that people have been hesitant to discuss since then. You know, again, we had, you know, in the Afghanistan Papers, the book, there are all these really striking quotes and commentary from people who had given interviews that they thought wouldn't be made public to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. And I was able to, in the Washington Post, we sued under FOIA for these statements, these interviews that people had done. For the book, we obtained all these oral histories that hadn't been previously been made public, where people were speaking really forthrightly about how bad the war was going because they thought they couldn't get in trouble for it. They didn't think their comments would be made public. So, you know, for once, they were honest about just how bad things were over there. But it was only because they had that freedom where they thought they wouldn't get in trouble, they wouldn't be held accountable. But again, since we published all these in the Afghanistan Papers, you know, nobody's disputed any of it. Some people have come out and said, well, yeah, I should have said something publicly, you know, and I'm wrestling with that, you know, that why didn't I or other people, you know, I had a responsibility to the American people to tell the truth, even if it would be bad for my career or might invite reprisals. I had a bigger responsibility here. You know, other people haven't quite been so brave and kind of wish the remarks would go away. But, you know, this is an ongoing issue that we really need to address as a society and a government, because this is going to happen again and again in other national security crises where, you know, what's this dilemma of how much should we level with the American people if things aren't going well? You know, how much of the truth do we need to tell them when things are going the other way? And how much of a responsibility do people in charge have to be honest? And I think what that's honestly my personal viewpoint is that one reason the war in Afghanistan dragged on for 20 years is that more people didn't have the courage to tell the truth. And one of the big reasons for that is they knew that they would suffer in their careers. You know, we saw one commander in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, who was the commanding officer of all U.S. forces in Afghanistan under both Bush and Obama in 2008-2009. And he was the one commanding officer who in public was saying things weren't going well. He admitted that things weren't going in the right direction, and he ended up getting fired. He was sacked by Bob Gates. And even though Gates didn't mention it at the time, it was clear that one reason he got sacked was because he was being pessimistic and honest in public. And you know, the people in charge didn't want to hear that. So anyway, when McKiernan was fired back in 2009, the message was sent out loud and clear to everybody else at the Pentagon and the State Department of, you know, don't be honest. Don't tell the public that things aren't going well, because if you do, that's contrary to the official line and you'll pay for it. And so that's one reason the war, I think, went on as long as it did, is sure. People were afraid of their careers would come to an end. They would, their, whether in uniform or not. And that's why this war dragged on for 20 years, because They had to keep this myth up that we were winning over there, even though people who were in charge knew that was not the case.
Sure. Echoes of Vietnam, Secretary McNamara keeping his doubts private and so on, slipping out of the government in the dark of the night, you might say, to go to the World Bank. Remind us what the CIA's role was in this deception, self-deception, cover-up of the lack of progress in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, there's some irony here too, right? That the CIA isn't exactly known as being the most honest and forthright in public. That's not their job, to be truth tellers in public. But, you know, they had a pretty consistent record through the war of being much more pessimistic than the U.S. military. And a lot of their intelligence assessments that were classified, cast a lot of doubt on the feasibility of winning this war, or at least on the ability of the Afghan government that we had propped up to stay in power. You know, starting in 2007, 2008, they were sounding, you know, some real concerns about the Taliban gradually coming back. And for the next 15 years, they were the ones who were much more pessimistic than U.S. military. But, you know, of course, they're limited in what they can say in public. They, you know, the CIA director might go testify a couple times a year before Congress and give some, you know, formal statements about how different hotspots in the world are going according to their public assessments. But, you know, the U.S. military can send people out on television anytime it wants. So the generals were out in public telling people that the war was going well, that, yes, there have been some setbacks here and there, but we're making progress. I believe in the war. The mission's going well. We see light around the corner. And that was drowning out the private warnings from the CIA that this war was not going well, that the Afghan government was corrupt to the core, that the Taliban was getting stronger and stronger. And so that much more realistic assessment, more realistic message was completely overshadowed by what the Pentagon, the State Department, and the White House were saying under four administrations.
Did there come a time when any of the CIA directors during the Afghan War, starting George Tenet, Michael Hayden, so on and so forth, marched into the Oval Office and told the president directly, you can't win, you're not winning this thing, and the situation is bleak, and you're probably not going to win it? Or did they tell the intelligence oversight committees that this is a loser?
You know, I don't know if they told the president that. I certainly don't think during the George W. Bush administration that his CIA directors were telling him that the war, maybe they were giving him assessments, but I don't think they were telling him the war was unwinnable. And you'll recall, you know, Obama was the president who greatly expanded the war with the surge and sending 100,000 U.S. troops over there. And, you know, his whole government had a stake in that. It's just that starting particularly after bin Laden was killed, ironically, in 2011, which was in retrospect the time that the United States probably should have pulled out. But after that, it was kind of all downhill from there. The United States had started to gradually withdraw its forces. And this was all premised on the idea that the Afghan government and its army and police force could stand up on their own two feet and defeat the insurgency with less and less U.S. help. Well, you know, that was the strategy in a nutshell that was adopted by Obama and to a lesser extent by Trump and Biden. But, you know, that's what never panned out. You know, the Afghan government didn't have legitimacy in the eyes of the public because it was, you know, frankly, the democracy was a sham. And, you know, many Afghans saw their own government as corrupt. And, you know, but that was the plan that several presidents had stuck with. Now, to what degree were the CIA directors going into the Oval Office and telling Obama, Trump, or Biden that the jig was up? I don't know. But I kind of doubt they, you know how presidents consume their intelligence better than me. But, you know, they get it through reports and national intelligence estimates. And, you know, things are a lot more soberly worded. But certainly, I think the CIA reports that we're aware of were much more pessimistic all along than the U.S. military's, you know, shine on things.
Mm-hmm. And looking back with the now crazy Michael Flynn, who had a short stint as director of Defense Intelligence Agency, when he was in Afghanistan, he authored a highly controversial, co-authored a highly controversial paper saying that we have no human intelligence or effective human intelligence going on there. We don't really know what's going on out there in the countryside. Okay, we're back. I want to move on to this Afghanistan War Commission that just opened its doors, had its first, second hearing in July. What do you make of that? Is this going to be some sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or is it just another whitewash? What do you make of this thing?
It's definitely not a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And just to remind people, the Afghanistan War Commission was set up by Congress back in 2021 with the direction to essentially learn lessons of what went wrong in Afghanistan, so that if something like this happens again, where we get involved in a war overseas, that we don't repeat the same mistakes, right? Which makes sense, but
why don't they just read your book?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of good lessons in there that and that was the irony, is that the book is based in large part on secret interviews that the Special Inspector General had done as part of a lessons learned project. And, you know, so many ironies after irony in this, that the Inspector General wanted to do a lessons learned project, actually got people to open up, but then tried to hide what they really said. And the Washington Post and I had to sue for those statements and those interviews. And yeah, so people were pretty forthright for that. But, you know, if it hadn't been for the Post and our FOIA lawsuit, you know, none of that would have come to light. So now you have an Afghan War Commission that's been brought in, given 5 years to they don't have to come out with a report till August of 2026.
Sounds like a make work initiative here.
They had their first public hearing last month, and I don't want to cast aspersions on them publicly. But
go ahead.
their own leaders have said they're not going to name and shame people, right? This isn't an accountability thing where they're going to put people's feet to the fire, but they're going to kind of take a step back and do more of a, you know, what broad policy lessons can we learn from this? And, you know, there's value in that, but it's not going to be a 9/11 report. That did name and shame people and did hold people to account in government. I don't think it's going to be anything like that. It's, you know, they don't have big name people who have their own independent political bases who are involved in this. It's nonpartisan, it's bipartisan, but they're not going to name and shame people. It's just going to be more of an academic look at what went wrong in Afghanistan. And, you know, that's fine, but I don't think it's going to make big headlines with their findings.
And by the time they get through, key actors in the Afghanistan war who lied, deceived the American people and themselves and their superiors, could be dead. I mean, this is, Washington at work.
Speaking of which, like Donald Rumsfeld, right? You know, he passed away a couple years ago, and, you know, there's a lot of big questions. You know, what happened in 2001, after the Taliban essentially abandoned Kabul, under U.S. pressure in the Northern Alliance, you know, there's still debate to what degree was the Taliban trying to give up or reconcile way back in December of 2001. Could this whole war, this insurgency, have been averted if Rumsfeld and Bush had agreed?
Just said, we won. Well, we're leaving.
But not just that, but to let the Taliban be part of a reconciled Afghan government, to bring them back into the fold as a defeated party. But instead, they saw them as, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, they hosted Al-Qaeda. You know, we're going to hunt them down and kill them. So that was, in retrospect, an enormous mistake, because the Taliban, they weren't defeated. They subsided. They faded back into Afghan life. But eventually the insurgency took root, and, you know, that's what led to this 20-year war that we could never get our arms around, was how do you handle this insurgency, this popular insurgency? And, you know, was there legitimately a moment in 2001 when there could have been actual reconciliation that would have averted the need for the U.S. to be there as long as it did? Those are really important questions. Is this Afghanistan War Commission going to answer that definitively? You know, I'm not holding my breath, but as a historian, or historians out there who are smarter than me, you know, that's something to really chew on. And that would be really interesting to get people's firsthand assessments of. You know, Rumsfeld's not with us anymore, but certainly there's classified material about meetings and memos that would be could really cast new light on that moment in 2001. And similarly, when bin Laden was killed in 2011, was there a moment then? Was there a real debate in the Obama administration over whether that was the time to pull out or not? Or, you know, we don't know of it in public. You know, it seemed like Obama just kept going. But, you know, was that another pivotal moment that we missed that could have ended the war 10 years early? I don't know. But those are interesting questions to me that are still relevant today. I just don't know that this war commission is going to have the juice to answer them.
Yeah. You know, I go back to Vietnam where, you know, intelligence analysts pretty early on said, you know, why the other guys are winning is that the Viet Cong really represent the nationalist aspirations of the Vietnamese people. That's a real important part of why they are succeeding in the countryside. All you had to do is read the memoirs of former KGB officials like Oleg Kalugin, who did an inspection visit to Kabul when the Red Army, when the Russians, Soviets, were propping up the Afghan governments, and they came back to Moscow and said, that's a loser. And the reason is because the Mujahideen represent the traditional cultural values of the Afghan people in the countryside. And I say, you know, Afghan people, there's a wide variety of Afghan people with their own cultural facets and so on. So here we go into Vietnam, and we've just sort of into Afghanistan, and we've ignored this history that we learned personally in Vietnam. We haven't studied the Soviet results that I know of, or not closely, or didn't heed the Soviets. We knew this because we backed the Mujahideen against the Red Army, and we knew that one of the reasons they succeeded is because the Mujahideen represented the cultural contours and aspirations of the Afghan people. And then we turn around and we ignore all these things. Well, after the experiences of Afghanistan and Iraq, you have to say there's no place left for us to invade in the Middle East. So these lessons we're learning aren't applied to are not applicable to anything because we're not going anywhere in the Middle East. I don't know. Are we going to invade what? Saudi Arabia? I don't think so. So anyway, Craig, great to have you on the show again and to go over this dolorous history. We don't want to wallow in it, but we don't want to forget it either, what happened 3 years ago.
And there's a real danger in that, Jeff. I mean, you know, you talk about failing to learn the lessons of Vietnam and what the Russians experienced in Afghanistan was. The irony at the start of the U.S. war in Afghanistan in 2001, both Bush and Rumsfeld were asked about this, you know, in primetime press conferences, are we going to get stuck in a quagmire like we did in Vietnam? Or are we going to make the same mistake the Russians did? And, you know, it wasn't that Bush and Rumsfeld weren't aware of that. They both said in public, no, we're fully aware of those mistakes. Rumsfeld didn't want to send many troops to Afghanistan because he didn't want to make the same mistake as the Russians. Bush said in the White House at a primetime press conference, we're not going to make the same mistakes we did in Vietnam. So they thought they knew the lessons, but the irony was, you know, as time went on, those lapsed and they fell into the same trap without seeing as it happened in slow motion. So, you know, hopefully we're not going to invade another country halfway around the world in our lifetimes. But, you know, there's that risk of that happening. And there's an even greater risk of us not learning those lessons and holding them close. Because, you know, memories fade and, you know, there's arrogance and hubris. And we think we learn this history, but, you know, it doesn't sink in very often.
And the lessons that officials can take away from this is that you can screw up. You can lie to the American people. You can lie to the president. You can lie to Congress and you can get away with it. There is no accountability. Nobody gets put in the barrel. Nobody's held accountable and punished and left to live a life of penury and shame, you know, for the mistakes that these are not just, you know, tactical think tank exercises. These mistakes cost the lives of millions of people.
Well, and I think that's a real sore point in the ranks of the U.S. military and among veterans who served in Afghanistan. That more and more I hear nowadays, people just people who served there who weren't commanding officers feel that, you know, they did their job. They carried out the mission as it was handed to them. And they feel like there is no accountability at the top, both militarily and politically. And that's something that really sticks in people's craws, that they did their jobs. And the people at the top who had a responsibility to the American people and to the people serving under them, you know, no one's been held accountable. The only, you know, of course, General McKiernan got fired, but, you know, that was because he was being open and telling the truth about what was going. You know, no general got fired for a failed strategy in Afghanistan or for not measuring up to their promises. And I think that's something, you know, that in history, people in the military really care about. And, you know, I don't foresee that happening, but that's something that really stings a lot of veterans who served in Afghanistan, that, you know, people weren't, you know, they weren't held to the fire on this. And, you know, that goes against the culture of the U.S. military, that there should be accountability in situations like this.
It stings me as a Vietnam veteran. It's like living through this again. Thank God I wasn't around eligible to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, but, you know, it's all the same thing. And I was really embittered for many years more. Now I'm more stoic about it, but there are tens of thousands of wounded warriors walking our streets, succumbing to opiates and PTSD and other issues. And these generals and politicians that led us astray in Afghanistan are, you know, living lives of sweet luxury. Don't want to leave it totally on a downer. I want to tell people or remind people that the Afghanistan Papers isn't the only book you've written or even the latest book you've written. And your last book, Fat Leonard, has a happy ending of sorts. Well, how many, speaking of accountability, how many senior Navy officers have been indicted or sent to prison because they accepted bribes and other annuities from this Malaysian swindler known as Fat Leonard?
Yeah, you know, as I report in quite detail in the book Fat Leonard, you know, there's exactly one U.S. Navy admiral who was found guilty in federal court and served 18 months in jail. And actually not, even though he was accused of taking bribes, he pleaded guilty to lying to federal agents, which, you know, he did lie. But as I reveal in the book, there were actually more than 90 admirals retired in active duty who were investigated over 10 years for taking gifts or bribes or just their interactions with Fat Leonard. But only one of them ended up going to prison or paying any sort of meaningful penalty. And, you know, that's another scandal where in terms of a lack of accountability at the top for, you know, for real crimes in this case, not just crimes of command or failure to execute, but actual legal crimes. It's a pretty shocking, but, you know, I'd like to think a gripping narrative, this story of how this Malaysian high school dropout, a guy named Fat Leonard, how he was able to penetrate the mighty U.S. Navy for 20 years to the point where he was steering ships and aircraft carriers to ports he preferred in Asia. That's another eye-opening read, but that's a world away from Afghanistan, but it's another eye-opener. I'll say that.
It's a story that could have been in Gilbert and Sullivan. It's just extraordinary. But there's one little happy ending to that. Is Fat Leonard is in our hands now.
That's right, and you know the book. I won't give away the endings or spoil the drama in between, but he had actually escaped to Venezuela, believe it or not. He had escaped federal custody and danced across the border to Mexico, ended up in Venezuela, and he was brought back in a prisoner swap engineered by the White House last December. Leonard Francis is finally scheduled for sentencing in federal court in November of this year. So we'll finally learn what punishment he gets for orchestrating the most extensive corruption scandal in military history.
It's a marvelous story, an astounding story, and in many parts, it's sort of a police procedural. You know, I mean, you know, it's not only these naval, you know, fleet officers who were taking bribes and, you know, accepting booze, prostitutes, and so on from Fat Leonard as he's called. But the NCIS, the vaunted, the legendary NCIS, is celebrated on TV every week and so on. They didn't exactly wrap themselves in glory in their part of the story either.
No, so Leonard Francis, again, you know, he's one of the greatest con men in history, in the sense that not only did he con U.S. Navy admirals into helping him defraud U.S. taxpayers of millions and millions of dollars, but he conned NCIS, the vaunted law enforcement agency, into, you know, he had an NCIS Special Agent of the Year on his illegal payroll, slipping him law enforcement files so that Leonard could always stay a step ahead of federal investigators. He also conned the Justice Department when he pleaded guilty and agreed to be a cooperating witness. I won't spoil all the revelations on that, but he conned the Justice Department. He conned a federal judge into all thinking they could trust him. And, you know, they all, again, speaking of a failure to learn lessons that are staring you right in the face, you know, it's just kind of amazing how the Navy, NCIS, Justice Department, a federal judge all failed to learn the lesson of Fat Leonard, which is that he is a con man and he's always got a racket up his sleeve, and yet they all fell for it.
Well, as they say in show business, let's leave him laughing, Craig. Leonard's a great story. It's a nice counterbalance to the horrible story, Afghanistan, which is just a poison in our government bloodstream, and it'll never go away as much as officials might want to sweep it under the rug. And this month we're reminded of it. And certainly the Republicans are going to circulate a lot of video of the chaotic last days in Kabul and you know, try to pin it all on Biden when they set the stage themselves, or Trump set the stage himself for this horrible ending. Anyway, Craig Whitlock, thanks again for coming on the show. You're always a great guest, and people should read the Washington Post for you alone.
Well, thank you, Jeff. You bet. Thanks for having me, and great talking with you again.
Thanks, Craig. It was great. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk. You'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. Tune in next week for an interesting show with my Spy Talk colleague, Michael Isikoff. Oh, and by the way, that music, it's the popular Afghan singer Salara Hashimi. We're not sure if she safely escaped the Taliban. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.